And our sermon text today is Ecclesiastes, chapter 1, verses 12 to 18. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. But in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. In the late 60s, when I was in college, they had college back then, I took it upon myself to answer the four great questions of life. Is there a God? From whence did I come? To whither do I go? What is the meaning of it all? Of course, I went at it with great affectation and pretension, as if no one had ever done this before or asked these questions. I grew my hair long. I sat around in dark coffee houses smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and looked morose and despairing. We listened to folk singers like Pete Seeger and Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, and it was important to read the correct authors, too. So I read men like Albert Camus, Jean-Paul Sartre, and most importantly, Franz Kafka. Franz Kafka was a Czech from the ghetto in Prague. He had all the credentials for a proper existentialist. He grew up under an abusive father in a time and place where Jews were hated and persecuted. And in his own mind and emotional state, he was filled with depression, sorrow, and hopelessness. But he was a gifted writer. He even viewed this, though, not as a gift, but a curse. And I quote him now. You get a sense for what existentialists were like at this time. He says, writing is a deep sleep, deeper than death. Just as one wouldn't pull a corpse from its grave, I can't be dragged from my desk at night. Wow. We thought that was very profound. Nevertheless, Kafka wrote and he published too. And his works expressed quite articulately the sense of despair and meaninglessness current in the beat generation of the 50s and 60s that later morphed into the hippies of the 60s and 70s. And one of my favorites was his short story, The Metamorphosis, that beautifully encapsulated the meaninglessness and random absurdity of life. And he says, begins the book by, as Gregor Samsa awoke one morning from uneasy dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a gigantic insect. And it only goes downhill from there. Well, what struck me in that day was an anthology of existentialist writers I bought in a used bookstore that included Kafka, Camus, and Sartre, and Nietzsche. And guess who? Guess who else? Koheleth, the preacher, Solomon, included in this anthology of existentialist despair writers who seemed included meaninglessness, despair, and vanity, was this Old Testament book of the Bible. It seemed that as hard as I tried, I couldn't get away from the Bible and its power at that time. For some lighter contrast, I have been following the career of football coach Mike Kafka. of the New York Giants. He was also a quarterback for the Eagles at one time, so he's been in football for quite a while, trying to win a Super Bowl. Hopeless, right? Hopeless for so many teams. So as we consider Solomon and his little book of vapor under the sun, we too will come full cycle from things like Franz Kafka's serious philosophy all the way to Mike Kafka's frivolous entertainment, right? I know some of you are dedicated football fans and you don't see football as frivolous, but in the long run, it is. So this is a tale of two Kafkas in a way. Let us take upon ourselves a little bit of that sense of Kafkaesque sense of the absurd and despair today as we look at what Solomon hints at what it means to be under the sun. Okay? From our text today, Ecclesiastes 12:1-18, 2 points I'd like to make with you. First of all, from verses 12 through 15. Wind. It's our title today. We looked at vapor. How fleeting is vapor? How fleeting is the wind, the breeze, right? Those of sincere heart and godly wisdom will find in the end that all that is done under heaven is inscrutable and incomplete. Verses 12 through 15 of chapter 1. Now, as we look at our text today, the preacher, or Koheleth, as we like to call him, we leave that Hebrew word untranslated. We discern that this indeed is Solomon by his declaration in verse 12. I, the preacher, or Ecclesiasticus, or Koheleth, as we're going to call him, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. Well, how does this verse tell us that this indeed is Solomon and not another king further down the dynasty? Well, ask yourself, how many kings ruled Israel from Jerusalem? In order to answer this, one must keep in mind that Israel per se was only ruled by two kings, David and Solomon, after him. If you remember your history, you remember what transpired after the death of Solomon. The kingdom split between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Rehoboam and those after him ruled in Jerusalem over Judah, while Jeroboam and those after him ruled over Israel from Shechem in Ephraim. So there were only two kings who ruled over Israel proper from Jerusalem, David and his son Solomon. Now, our author declares, in fact, that he acquired wisdom surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. That is David and Saul, all the wise men who could be mustered, counted there, right? So the only candidate who could here be considered is Solomon. It is he who composed this book. That's under dispute in many quarters. So I just want to affirm that again. As the wisest man who ever lived, no arrogance here, he was indeed the wisest man who ever lived. He then begins the quest that your humble servant, myself, so pretentiously set out back in the 60s, right? Only Solomon lived in the 10th century BC. And he was a bit more gifted on the wisdom scale than me. Yeah. Our text declares that I applied my heart. And that's not always the full strength translation that might be used here. Because this is not a rock and roll sentiment gushed out on the red carpet runway in Beverly Hills. Rather, this is the tenacity of a Lance Armstrong winning the Tour de France after battling cancer. This is the kind of application of oneself, the dedication and commitment of an Olympian champion like Michael Phelps, getting up at 4 every morning to swim laps and train, eventually breaking Mark Spitz's record of 7 gold medals by accumulating 8 in Beijing. That's the sense of application that Solomon brings to wisdom, to accumulating wisdom. Sense in which Koheleth dedicates himself to seek and to search out all that is done under heaven. Once again, and that's a synonym with done under the sun. That is, on the earth, in the lives of the average man. And there's a repetitive emphasis throughout this. Verse 13, verse 16, verse 17. I applied my heart. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And true to Proverbs, in this sense, true to Proverbs, this is exactly the kind of commitment with which one is to seek wisdom. Okay? For it is by wisdom that he will explore all that is done under heaven. Proverbs tells us in chapter 3, blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding, for the gain from her is better than gain from silver and her profit better than gold. So, this is Solomon's declaration of intent, whereby he generally declares what he's about during his reign. David, being a man of war, quelling all of Israel's enemies, allowing Solomon the space to pursue life via wisdom in the manner that's outlined here. So, from here on out, all through the book, he will explore the particular things done under the sun, one by one. He will work and think. He will spoil himself with pleasure and sexual gratification, and he'll ponder it. He will build lavish monuments in stone that men trust will endure long after they're gone, until they're torn down by progressive protesters. And Koheleth will consider it all. He will rule as a vaunted king, with a worldwide reputation for wisdom. And he will bluntly tell us what that is worth. He will be so awash in wealth that it becomes a proverb in Israel that silver was as plentiful as stones, cedar as common as sycamore of the Shephelah. And he will give us his own bottom line on all this too. But for now, in our text today, he is content with generalities, right? What does he say? He says, it was a blast. I had a rollicking good time as the big cheese of Israel. Is that what he says? No. He says, it's an unhappy business. An unhappy business. That's a good translation here. It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Now, just parenthetically, he uses the word Elohim all the way through here. God, that is the generic name for God known by all the surrounding countries. He does not use the covenant name Yahweh anywhere here. So he's talking in the broadest sense to a wide audience here, not just Israelites. Now, there's an uncomfortable truth that is expressed here that will ring like a bell throughout this tale of two Kafkas. That is, God gives a bunch of stuff, and not all of it is pleasant. God gives this unhappy business we call life. This unhappy business that we call life. As we saw last week with the burdensome toil under the sun, a direct allusion to the curse is both there and here as well. Remember, we keep reminding you of this. The curse is that under which Solomon labors as well. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. This lurks behind so much of what Solomon unfolds to us. And unlike the pagan cosmologies, this is no cosmic accident, no evolutionary happenstance. It's no random tragedy about which God can do nothing. No, rather, he caused it. He planned it. He gave it to us this way. And there's no getting around it. It comports precisely with the definition of the curse. definition of curse. That unchangeable set of circumstances of sin and misery above which no man can rise by his own power. The curse, a curse, in biblical terms, is that unchangeable set of circumstances of sin and misery above which no man can rise by his own power. That's what can be so despairing, right? About sin, about life under the sun. And indeed, Solomon does not polish the curse for us. He gives it to us unvarnished. Behind all of the brevity of things done under heaven, the frustration, the futility, the folly, the emptiness, lies the supreme folly of our first father, Adam. He aspired to the blessings of eternal Eden by his own power. And God frustrated it. He cursed it. And since then, we reprise constantly, we repeat constantly in every generation the precise thing for which Adam aspired. Eden on our own. Eden on our own. As a young man, following my generation, I aspired to Eden on our own. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, in their song on Woodstock, any of you gray hairs remember Woodstock? Maybe. Any of you there? If you remember, you probably weren't there. But they have a line in the song, Woodstock. We are stardust. We are golden. We are billion-year-old carbon. And we got to get ourselves back to the garden. Now, besides being bad English, that's also bad theology, isn't it? We got to get ourselves back to the garden. Get ourselves back to the garden. That's precisely what Solomon is talking about here. Eden on our own. What happens when we try to grasp Eden and make the Garden of Eden on our own? Well, Koheleth will labor by all appearances as Adam did, as Crosby, Stills, and Nash sang about. With this exception, he will do it by wisdom. He will check that tendency we all have to get Eden on our own. He will not sink into meaninglessness or vanity or despair, ultimately. And neither should you, dear listener. We may have found this book of Ecclesiastes, or this book of Ecclesiastes in this anthology of despair and meaninglessness, but that is not what Solomon means. He would have sued for property rights to this book if he had found this in his anthology. If Solomon were alive today, he'd be rolling over in his grave, as we observed last week, right? Well, we share the same planet. We share the same country. We share the same neighborhood as our lost brothers and sisters in Adam, don't we? The same sun shines on us all. The same rain falls on our heads as theirs. The same joys and pleasures, sorrows and tragedies, too. They come to us all. Well, it is this atmosphere that Koheleth cultivates throughout our text, okay? Deliberately. And wisdom will speak directly to the universal impulse to grab Eden on our own. And Koheleth will hint at what wisdom finds behind that fleshly impulse. Well, what does Koheleth say to that impulse for Eden on our own? He says, I have seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vapor and a striving after wind. All is vaporous. not meaningless, not vain, but vaporous, and a striving after wind, both so brief, are they not? Poof, Mr. President. Every president strives for lasting legacy, including the one who occupies. Does he really occupy? That's a question we must ask. Does he really occupy with full faculties the office of president? Huh? For what it's worth, Mr. Roosevelt, for example, if we go back, Social Security, how long is that going to last, huh? It'll soon be thrown on the scrap heap of socialist history as we go into bankruptcy. For what it's worth, Mr. Eisenhower, the great interstate highway system you built, your lasting legacy, right? It will crumble into dust as soon as we run out of money. Within a few generations, it might dissolve into dust. Mr. President, what has happened to your legacy? Just presidents. It's true throughout history, isn't it? Or the great kings as well. Shelley, the poet Shelley, wrote this poem, Ozymandias. He said, I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, and near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well these passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked them and the heart that fed, and on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretched far away. Ozymandias, who had a kingdom of marble, now broken, rules over a kingdom of sand. And that's precisely what Koheleth says is in store for all of us. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vapor and a striving after wind. Well, if this is true of presidents and kings, what of peons like us? In the grand scheme of things, that's another way we put of saying what's under the sun, in the grand scheme of things, all that is done by everyone is vaporous. Like steam rising, like smoke spiraling, like a breath on a winter morning, right? This is the burden of the curse. This is its reality. This is how it is played out on the grand stage of life. You and I know this truth, do we not? We know this reality. It is the curse that has undone all. The wise will factor this in as he goes on his way. That is a vital component of wisdom. The curse has undone all. But from the perspective of our fellow man with whom we dwell under the sun, that's important now, but from the perspective of our fellow man with whom we dwell under the sun, this cannot be fathomed. The natural man cannot find it out. To him, as soon as he begins to grasp and understand it, poof, it evaporates. As soon as he begins to penetrate to the bottom of a question, like Kafka, whoosh, it's gone like the wind, right? That's a sense of striving after wind, synonymous with that which is vaporous, okay? And so it will seem to you as well, O fool, if you employ only the wisdom and knowledge that exists under the sun. Jesus wisely employs this very sense of the wind. We had that read for us, did we not, this morning? Jesus answered, truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born of the water and the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. That which is born of flesh is flesh. That which is born of the Spirit is spirit. Do not marvel at that I said to you, you must be born again. The wind blows where it wishes, and you hear its sound, but you do not know where it comes from or where it goes. So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. There's that same sense of mystery the world has, unfathomable wisdom. But those of the Spirit do know and comprehend. The world, from the perspective of our fellow man with whom we dwell under the sun, it cannot be fathomed. The wisdom cannot be fathomed. These truths cannot be fathomed. So, from all that we can gather from the evidence presented to us under heaven, under the sun, the proverb is true. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. This proverb. What does this mean anyway? What's he talking about? Is he going crazy already? He's plumbing the depths of madness. Is he mad? Well, Koheleth worked very hard to form these proverbial sayings, these little ditties, right? We know, he says in his closing, that he spent his time weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. And so we should do the same in interpreting them. Now, the Old Testament Hebrew notion of crooked is that which is obscure, hidden, and concealed. The Old Testament Hebrew notion of straight, on the other hand, the antonym, is that which is clear, open, and revealed. Isaiah says, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. That is clear and evident and traversable. Did you ever go hiking and lose the trail? Hopefully that won't happen to our team when they go camping here or backpacking. They won't lose their trail and we never hear from them again, huh? The righteous, then, by analogy, are straight. That is, they're open and genuine and honest. What you see is what you get. The righteousness of the blameless keeps his way straight, as the Proverbs say. On the other hand, the wicked are crooked. That is, they have hidden motives, not what they seem. They are disingenuous. Proverbs says, put away from you crooked speech and put devious talk far from you. Men whose paths are crooked and who are devious in their ways. That's the sense of crooked, right? So it is with knowledge and understanding, too, by analogy. Proverbs 8:8-9 say, all the words of my mouth are righteous. There is nothing twisted or crooked in them. They are all straight to him who understands, and right to those who find knowledge. So this is precisely what our text puts before us today, okay? God hides this general truth from the natural man. He is crooked with him in that sense. The natural man cannot plumb its depths. He cannot find it out in general revelation, that is, things which are under the sun. God intentionally makes his world and his ways utterly inscrutable, in other words. God intentionally makes his world and his ways utterly inscrutable. The Oxford English Dictionary defines inscrutable as holy, mysterious, impenetrable. So without the aid of a word spoken from above the sun, that is from heaven, by God, we would know nothing of this. We would know nothing of God. The natural man has never in the past, cannot now, nor will he ever penetrate to the bottom of things. Lay unto eternal, lasting, abiding truth. He won't do this by his own natural wisdom. It will always prove to be as enduring as a vapor, as fruitful as chasing after a breeze. If you are with us, this past 4th of July, as the parade went by, you may remember the float that spouted bubbles, right? Boy, that was fun. That was fun for me as an adult. But one float was sprouting bubbles all over the place, and the kids were chasing the bubbles, and they just about get a hold of one, and pop, away it went. And I thought, I'm going to use that this Sunday. Because that's precisely what Koheleth is saying earthly wisdom below the sun is like. Our Proverbs companion phrase also echoes the same truth. What is lacking cannot be counted. There's an old blues line that says, you can't spend money you don't have. You can't count numbers that aren't there. You can't prove a negative, right? All of these along the same line. And the atheist is a fool, precisely because there's no way you can prove that there is no God. So it is, the fool cannot arrive at ultimate, lasting, enduring truth, for which there is no evidence. God has purposely made it insufficient for him. It is incomplete. So it is this that Koheleth laments. It is this that Koheleth laments, right? He grieves. What lost man who thinks, doesn't know this, doesn't feel this himself, right? Well, what is the net effect upon him then? That brings us to point two, verses 16 to 18. Wind. The wind is as brief, as vaporous, and as uncapturable as is the mist, as is vapor. Those of sincere heart and godly wisdom will find in the end that the world's inscrutability and incompleteness is grievous. This is what grieves the heart of Solomon. Now, Koheleth gives us a summary statement of his relative success in his aspirations. He got what he was after. 1 Kings, for example, details his quest for and attainment of wisdom. 1 Kings chapter 3 tells us, give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people? Right? This is what he asked for. And God was pleased that Solomon had asked for wisdom, and he gave it abundantly, such that we must take him at his word that no one before or since possessed this gift in more abundance than Solomon. Until who? Right? Until the true eternal son who would sit on David's throne came. And our text tells us in 1 Kings chapter 4 that God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore. And his fame was in all the nations. Can you begin to see why many thought that this was the promised Redeemer who would fulfill the Davidic covenant, the promise of that covenant in 2 Samuel chapter 7, where God promises David, I will raise up your offspring after you, and I will establish his kingdom. I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Solomon gave good evidence to begin with that their hopes might not be in vain. Note that he also pursued the knowledge of madness and folly. That is, he decided to go into politics and work for the government and solve the world's problems. I'm being only partly facetious. The knowledge of madness and folly is not quite the same as being a mad fool. Perhaps he didn't set out to become a mad fool, but only seek to understand it and its tragic pitfalls. But Solomon did walk that tightrope, didn't he? He walked that tightrope, and he fell off. In the end, he fell prey to one of the themes I outlined for you in the introduction. He fell prey to the Chicago way. I put it that way because I saw it lived in the 13 years we lived in Chicago. He loved many foreign women. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen. That's a lot of cars, isn't it, in our terms these days? You think you have an antique car collection? Well, Solomon had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horses. His weakness, Solomon's weakness, is what I saw living close to Arlington Park, where they race horses. Women and horses, and all that surrounded it, gambling and booze and money, the whole thing. And like our first parents, who saw that the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was good for food, and it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desired to make one wise. Yeah. She did what? She did what? Right? So did Solomon. He saw that women and horses were good for fun, a delight to the eyes and the senses, and that he'd know madness and folly to the full by indulging himself. And what was his conclusion? I perceive that this also is a striving after wind. This is a striving after wind in verse 17, right? And so you see why so many of the Proverbs are the voice of bitter experience. He says in one of them, he who commits adultery lacks sense. He who does it destroys himself. Or, the Lord's delight is not in the strength of a horse. 12,000 of them, right? The Lord's delight is not in the strength of a horse, nor his pleasure in the legs of a man, but the Lord takes pleasure in those who fear him. Bitter experience. Indeed, the sorrow and the grief that accompany true wisdom, whether it's gained by example, wisdom is knowledge gained by observation of others' example, right? Or whether it's gained by experience, that is, folly is knowledge gained by experience. That's a short definition of folly, isn't it? It's knowledge gained by experience. In other words, you are the one broken in the end. Sorrow and grief accompany true wisdom, don't they? It's common to those who gain wisdom. What parent doesn't watch with grief, for example, a son go out on his own to experiment with things like drugs and rock and roll? Even a little bit of common sense tells them that this path will only end in sorrow, pain, and death. So it is with friends and workmates or anyone we love who plays the fool in any fashion. I have a cousin in New York whose son, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, succumbed to that rap subculture. He's a white kid, right? Thought he was a black rapper, tried to mimic and aspire to the lifestyle too, with his profanity and drugs and violence and eventual brokenness as well. The pain and the grief of wisdom is watching so many of those you love live like fools and suffer as a consequence. This too then is vapor. This too is vaporous. And so it is with the wisest one who ever lived. He also grieved, did he not? As our text read today from the Old Testament, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. The wisest man who ever lived, also acquainted with grief. Much of that grief was precisely because of the foolishness of those he loved. Excuse me. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them, Matthew tells us, because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. But what has this good shepherd, this wise good shepherd, what has he done then in his wisdom? Well, the text from Isaiah tells us, does it not? He says, surely he has borne our griefs the grief of the fall, the grief of sin, the grief of our brokenness in it. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his wounds, we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He has taken your folly upon himself. Eden on our own. It breaks every man who tries it. Everyone who tries it is a fool committing folly. But our Lord has taken our folly upon himself. So, will you be wise in listening to this word from above the sun? We've heard many words from under the sun, and we'll hear many more. But let us also listen to the word from above the sun. Well, let us now come to that place then where we find provision wisely put before us in simple, straight paths of the body and blood, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.